everyone. I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. From England during the Norman Conquest, we are taking a sharp turn to the mannered world of Jane Austen. This month, I'm interviewing Pamela Mingle, who in her second novel, The Pursuit of Mary Bennet, fills in the story of the least regarded sister in the family featured in Pride and Prejudice. Mary is a classic middle child, third of five girls living in a small but comfortable house in rural England. In the days when young women needed a dowry to attract a husband, a father might be forgiven for thinking himself more cursed than blessed by having five daughters to provide for. Jane, the eldest, is beautiful. Lizzie, the second, has personality and wit. Daughters 4 and 5, Kitty and Lydia, show little evidence of sense, but they are charming. In 1820s society, charm is much more desirable in a gentlewoman than sense. But shy, awkward Mary, who plays the piano indifferently and sings like a crow, seems like such an unlikely prospect for marriage that even her own mother has given up hope, as Mary discovers at the opening of the book. Chapter 1. Sometimes anger is a living thing. It rose up in my chest and made me want to chew thorns. They would tear at the tender flesh on the roof of my mouth, at my cheeks and tongue. When I swallowed, the sweet, salty taste of blood would linger on my palate, along with pointy bits of thorn. I squeezed my eyes shut, contemplating the pain. Why was I loitering outside the upstairs sitting room, eavesdropping on a conversation between my parents, especially since it aroused such ire in me? That couldn't be healthy. I leaned closer. To see all my girls but one settled, such joy, Mama said. Is Kitty engaged, then? My father asked. She soon will be, mark my words. We will have another wedding by Michaelmas. We had already celebrated three weddings in the family. My two elder sisters, Jane and Elizabeth, had wed wealthy and property gentlemen 3 years ago, Mr. Bingley and Mr. Darcy. Lydia, my youngest sister, formed a rather disastrous union with one Mr. Wickham, formerly of the militia, and went off to live in Newcastle as he was currently attached to a regiment quartered there. Only Kitty and I remained at home. Ah, you refer to Mr. Walsh, I assume, Papa said. Jane describes him as a reserved sort of fellow. Not at all the kind I thought Kitty would have chosen. Perhaps she is too eager to be wed. I nearly choked on the irony. Kitty's foremost preoccupation was with finding a husband. And success at last! She had lately acquired a beau, a friend of Mr. Bingley, whom she met during a lengthy stay with Jane and my brother-in-law, the very man my parents were now discussing. What do you mean? He's a handsome man and has £6,000 a year. You only met him the once, Mr. Bennet, and cannot have formed a correct impression. And anyway, who cares if he is reserved? Kitty, perhaps? I pressed my lips together to quell a laugh. I pictured Mama casting my father a severe look and knew his gaze in return would not waver. Walsh has made his attentions clear, then. Shall I expect a visit from him soon? Not yet, but it won't be long. Assured for some time of the matrimonial nature of the relationship, she had, I was quite certain, already spread the idea around the neighborhood. What of Mary? Does she wish to wed? Why was he inquiring about me? No one ever thought of me when marriage was discussed. I was a person of no consequence. I'd never had suitors, nor did I desire any. And now, please join me in welcoming Pamela Mingle. Hi, Pam. Thank you for agreeing to talk with me today.
Thank you for asking me.
I really enjoyed your book very much. I'm a great Pride and Prejudice fan, and I have to admit that I never thought much about Mary Bennet until I read your novel, and then it was quite interesting to find this entirely new story for her. Some of the material we're going to cover today is already in the back of your book and on your wonderfully informative website, but I'm going to try to branch out a bit to keep it interesting, both for you and for the people who have already read your book.
Okay, sounds good.
So before we get to the book itself, I'd like to find out more about you. I know that you were a librarian and a teacher before becoming a novelist. So tell us about that progression, where you come from and how you came to start writing novels.
Well, it seems like looking back, my whole life has pretty much revolved around books in one way or another. Of course, first as a reader, and then as a librarian, and finally as a teacher. You know, I'd always wanted to write, but I always had a career, so that limited me. I'm sure that that isn't true for some writers. I know of teachers, librarians, people in other professions who still manage to churn books out, but for me, that did not seem possible, especially after I started teaching. It was kind of an overwhelming obligation. But writing was always lurking in the back of my mind, and I always knew I wanted to write. One year when I was teaching, towards the end of my teaching career, my teammate came to me and said that she was retiring, and so that really got me to thinking. I had started thinking seriously that year, not even thinking, but actually started writing something pretty seriously that year. I had a student teacher, so that gave me a little extra time, and you know, I was getting up at ungodly hours to write before school. And anyway, I said to myself, you know, if you don't retire from teaching, when do you ever think you're going to write? So it kind of came down to, you know, making that choice. Did I want to pursue that? And I think my whole career, being in libraries all the time, being around kids who, you know, there's just nothing quite like watching the expressions on kids' faces when you're reading out loud to them, and they're just really taken with the book and the story. And that whole experience made me think, you know, I can do this. I can write for kids. And that was how I really started, was writing for young people. So I retired, and that was that.
So what were you, when you were teaching, what age level were you teaching?
I was teaching fourth and fifth, but mostly fifth. I spent a few years doing what we call looping, where I taught fourth, and then I took the same kids to fifth. And then that got to be kind of overwhelming because we had so much new curriculum to learn, and so I decided just to stick with fifth, which I liked better. So that was good.
So once you decided to write, was it difficult to make the shift?
It was difficult. It was really exciting. I mean, I was really excited about it. And sometimes when people retire, they don't have that element of excitement in their life. And so it's tougher. Having writing was exciting for me. However, it was difficult in that I had no idea how much I had to learn. I was making a very naive assumption that because I was a lifelong reader, you know, and loved books so much, that I guess somehow I thought by osmosis or something I would know how to write fiction. And that was, of course, really naive and wrong. I mean, there's a degree of truth to that. Certainly, if you want to write, you should also be a reader. But I had so much to learn about, you know, POV and narration and description and characterization and plotting, which is still my toughest thing. So, you know, I've joined a Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators known as SCBWI, started going to workshops, attending conferences, I joined a critique group, you know, did all those, took all those beginning steps that you really need to develop your craft. And I slowly made progress.
I think that's a very common assumption, actually. I mean, as a historian, I had that assumption also when I started writing fiction. I thought, well, I've been reading this stuff since I could read. And I think it's people underestimate how much of a craft there is in writing and how much work it takes. Precisely because, you know, when you're, like anything, especially any artistic thing, if you see it well done, it looks effortless.
Oh, absolutely. And you tend to think to yourself, I can do that, you know, because, gee, that doesn't look that hard. I can do that. And I know, do you remember the experience of getting your first critique from, you know, somebody who was either a writer or an editor? And I remember getting that at a conference, at one of the first conferences I went to, and being really crushed but when I heard what this editor thought of what I had written, that it was really amateurish, and you know, it was all those basic things like, oh gosh, show don't tell, and you know, you left feeling embarrassed and ashamed, and like you might never be able to improve. But I think that the key is realizing how much there is to learn and how far you have to go. And once you kind of accept that, then you can really take the steps to improve.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. I mean, I didn't get the scathing critique. I just got very nice rejection letters. And what I realized, and I found a critique group too, and that really, I mean, that was what actually got me over the hump and actually got me started to write in a serious way. But, and even before that, there was a very nice author friend of mine who tried gently to push me in the right direction. But I go back and I look at that early stuff that I sent to people and I just cringe. I think, how could I have thought it?
Because
the hard part that I think doesn't get really recognized, which is that once you get to the point of realizing how much you don't know, you're okay. But there's this long period before you get to that point where you don't know how much you don't know, and you don't realize how bad it is with the stuff that you're producing
on people. Right. That's exactly right, and it can be very painful to come to that realization this is really bad, and I have to improve if I'm going to go anywhere with this.
But the nice part is that it happens to everyone, I think. So eventually you did, and obviously you did get there. So you was Kissing Shakespeare, which is not the book we're talking about today, but it was your first published book. Was that the first book that you started working on?
No. Kissing Shakespeare was actually my fourth book.
Mm-hmm.
But wait, third or fourth book? I can't remember now. It was my fourth book, and first, let me just say briefly that Kissing Shakespeare is about a teenage girl who travels back to Shakespeare's time to help prevent him from becoming a priest, because if he became a priest, it then follows that he would not have become a playwright. So that's what that book is about. But I had recently finished a book about the great pandemic of 1918,
uh-huh.
And it was set here in Denver, and it won first place in a writing contest, and I was very encouraged. It was an encouraging time, but I was sort of in a lull. I was sending Pandemic, that was the name of the book, I was sending it out to various editors and agents, and so I was catching up on some reading, and I'm not generally a big nonfiction reader. My husband is, but I'm much more of a fiction reader, but occasionally if something really piques my interest, it's something that I have a love for or care about, and in this case it was Shakespeare. I don't know if you're familiar with a book called Will and the World by Stephen Greenblatt.
No, I'm not.
It was published in, I think, 2004. It's a wonderful biography of Shakespeare, one of those really accessible kinds of biographies, and it really attempts to define Shakespeare's life through his work, and for the most part. But there's the basic biographical facts about Shakespeare also in there, although about his early life not very much at all is known. But in reading that book, I came across just a very brief part of the book about the idea that some scholars believe that Shakespeare was a schoolmaster before he went to London, and it would have been when he was about 17 years old. And it was thought to be in the north of England. It was thought to be possibly because his family were Catholic and he needed to get away from from Stratford. And then there were Catholics in Stratford. There were Catholic schoolmasters, and Catholics were not well received at that time. You had mm-hmm. to kind of hide the fact that you were Catholic as a historian. I'm sure you know all about that much more than I do. Anyway, that immediately piqued my interest, and I thought, wow, wouldn't that be a great story to have Shakespeare, not as the main character, I would never be that bold, but to have him be a character in a story that was set in England amongst this, in the midst of this turmoil, and he's a schoolmaster, and so then I got, at first I didn't think about time travel, but then that became an element. I wanted to mix the contemporary with the past, because I frankly thought that would have a better chance of selling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't like to think about that as writers, but you have to. So I felt that that would give it more of an interest to a modern, a young adult reader, and it worked. So anyway, that was how I came to write Kissing Shakespeare, and it was a fun book to write. I loved doing the research and learning all about that era, and it was just great to get to revisit all of Shakespeare and, you know, go to the plays again, and I just had a lot of fun writing that book.
That's great. So that, as you mentioned, is a young adult novel, and but The Pursuit of Mary Bennet is really not a young adult novel. It's really for, I mean, I guess it would be good for teenagers as well, because teenagers like Pride and Prejudice too, but it's also for adults, right?
Correct, yeah. And I do hope some young people will read it. I think that some have, and certainly any one that enjoyed the Keira Knightley adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, I think would enjoy The Pursuit of Mary Bennet, you know. But it was not marketed towards a YA audience or a teen audience.
And was it a shift for you? I mean, obviously fifth grade isn't really it's some preparation for writing a young adult novel, but not so much. And then writing for adults is another mental shift.
You know, it wasn't particularly difficult to do that. I think the greatest challenge in writing Pursuit of Mary Bennet was simply taking that iconic story and trying to spin it out further. The good news was that lots of people had gone before me and had already, you know, there were countless sequels already written, so I knew it could be done. I knew that people had done it successfully. The tough part was having that in the back of your mind all the time, that you were working with this iconic story, and then trying to be true to what Austin did with the characters. I did not want to take the characters that existed, at least certainly not Jane and Elizabeth and, you know, the parents and their basic characters and personalities. I did not want to change those. So that was always present in my mind, thinking about trying to be true to Austin, to her voice, not her language so much, but her voice. And I'd say that was the hardest part, rather than the shift from, you know, I never consciously thought, oh gosh, I'm writing for adults now and I have to try to sound really grown up. that I didn't think about that. I think probably you don't, because all the aspects of story are much more in your mind.
Right. No, I think you're probably right about that. You've mentioned that writing a sequel to Pride and Prejudice was a little bit intimidating, and yet you were able to go, and I can understand why it would be intimidating, because it is such an iconic work, especially, and this is kind of interesting, in the last 20 or 30 years, it's become, I think, a much more iconic work.
Yes.
But you have done the novel, and you did a great job with it. You're a finalist for the Colorado Book Awards, I understand. And so what made you decide that Mary Bennet's story needed to be told?
Well, there were a number of reasons. I knew I didn't want to write about Elizabeth and Mr. Darcy, because to me their story is perfect. I mean, I wouldn't want to change that in any way. And I know that there are lots of sequel writers who have either changed their whole, you know, acquaintance prior to their marriage, or who have stepped in and written about them after they were married. That's probably the most common thing. But that, I knew that was not for me. And if you look up Austin sequels, there are zillions of them that have Mr. Darcy in the title. And, you know, I guess you can trace that all back to the 1995 adaptation of Pride and Prejudice that was done by the BBC that we watched here, and what people think of as the wet shirt.
Which, we have to break it to people, is not in the novel.
Yes.
Too bad.
And I don't know if you saw Colin Firth on Jimmy Fallon last week. Jimmy Fallon was kind of kidding him about it, and he very adamantly said that scene of him getting up out of the water was not even in the film. It wasn't there at all. But some extra actually dived into the water, and all they did was spritz some water on his shirt. And so I thought that he was a little bit touchy about that. That's kind of funny.
Apparently so. But it was a great scene. And there's apparently a very bizarre-looking statue in one of the rivers in London, I think it is.
Oh, I know.
That's, he looks positively alien in that statue.
I know. That's actually what Jimmy Fallon was kidding him about. He had posters of this statue. And he was showing the posters from various angles, and or the statue from various angles on these posters. And so it was, that's what kind of what made it funny. But anyway, I knew I didn't want to write about the principal characters, and I was kind of left with Mary and Kitty, because Jane, Elizabeth, and Lydia all had husbands and, you know, kind of had a wrap-up in some ways to their story, although I did bring Lydia pretty much back into Mary Bennett. But between Kitty and Lydia, I felt that Mary was the more interesting. She had the greatest potential to change, the greatest probably need to change, and to transform herself and try to go in a new direction. And I could kind of see that the way Austin wrote Mary, and that I could see her becoming a new person. And in the beginning of the book, of my book, Pursuit of Mary Bennett, she is discontented, she's misunderstood, she's facing a bleak future, and having these expectations thrust on her by her parents, and to some degree even from her sisters. So I guess I settled on Mary because I thought, here's the sister that has the greatest potential to change, and I can do something interesting with that.
Yeah, I'd like to talk more about Mary in just a minute. It's occurring to me that although I would imagine that a lot of the people who are going to listen to this interview will be already familiar with Pride and Prejudice, it's possible that not everyone will be. So could you give us a very brief description on the situation in the Bennett household in general, and what has happened by the end of Pride and Prejudice, and then especially what has changed between the end of Pride and Prejudice and the beginning of your story?
Yes, sure. At the end of Pride and Prejudice, you have, let's see, Jane, Elizabeth, and Lydia all married and leaving home. And that isn't really gone into in great detail, except you know that Lydia and Wickham have gone off to Newcastle, where he's now in a regiment. Mr. Wickham's now in a regiment there. And this, of course, was all arranged by Mr. Darcy, Elizabeth's husband. And again, I'm sure most people don't need an explanation of who Mr. Darcy is. But so the Bennett household at the end has, much to Mrs. Bennett's joy, married off three daughters and two to very wealthy husbands. Also, both Jane and Elizabeth have found love, have married for love, which, as we know throughout the novel, is a big thing for them. They're not interested in just making a match, although I would imagine they would have if it had been necessary. But in any case, that's the way things end at Longbourn, which is the Bennett family home. And we really don't know anything about what becomes of Mary and Kitty. I don't think she tells us anything. There's some speculation from Jane Austen's relatives, great nephews and so forth, about what she envisioned might happen to Mary and Kitty both. I think she has one of them married to a clergyman and one of them married to a solicitor's assistant or something like that. In any case, what has changed between the end of Pride and Prejudice and the beginning of my book, The Pursuit of Mary Bennett, is simply that these other sisters are gone. they're married, they're settled and married, as Mrs. Bennett would say. Jane and Elizabeth both have children. Jane has a son, a little baby son, and Elizabeth has twin daughters. That was kind of fun to, you know, think about how that would be. Lydia and Wickham are expecting a child, and as it turns out in my book, that child plays a very big role in the book, which is different because Austen doesn't usually have children in her books, but this is a baby, so a little bit different. Let's see, Kitty and her mother, Mrs. Bennett and Mary, the three of them are often invited to the homes of Jane and Elizabeth for visits. The mother, Mrs. Bennett, and Kitty more often than Mary. On a visit to Jane's home, which is called High Tor, Kitty becomes interested in a man named Henry Walsh, who's a close friend of Charles's, and she tries to fix his interest on her. Also, Mr. Bennett, back at Longbourn, has taken more of an interest in Mary, and he's tried to encourage her to read widely and kind of tried to further her education. She's had more piano instruction, and she's mellowed a little bit. She's more gracious and less judgmental. She still really lacks confidence in it, or as we would say today, self-esteem. And so she herself has noticed Mr. Walsh and has felt like he's noticed her. But due to her lack of confidence in herself and her lack of self-esteem, she can't possibly believe that he is interested in her. And she basically believes about herself that she's, you know, doomed to this life of looking after her sister's children, helping out with childbirths and visiting sick relatives, and then nursing her parents through their final years. So that's kind of where things stand at the beginning as the book opens.
Which is kind of, it tells you something about the position of woman in that time. In the actual beginning of Pride and Prejudice, the problem is that this family has five daughters and no sons, and so there's no one to inherit the estate, and they are likely to be put out by their cousin, Mr. Collins, who's going to inherit the estate and has the option of just throwing all of them on the street, basically. By the end, they've been saved from that fate because Lizzie and Jane are now married to men of fortune, and so they can support the rest of the family if something happens. But there's still this sense, I think, and it comes out very clearly for Mary at the beginning of your book, that if these girls don't marry, they're looking at that. There are very few options available for them in this society. They could become a governess, and for a young girl of that station, that's pretty much their only choice. Otherwise, and a governess is a kind of high class servant. You know, the governess, a companion to an older person, most likely an old lady, or they can live at home and take care of their parents and their nieces and nephews, as you mentioned. So, Mary is, I think, in a particular situation of difficulty. I mean, Kitty is flirtatious, like Lydia, and she is in a society that doesn't much value intellect or ambition or anything else in its women. It wants them to be sweet and decorative and good at the piano and other accomplishments, as they were called. Mary doesn't really fit in. Her piano playing has improved, as you say, but her personality doesn't really fit into this style. And even her parents, I mean, it's no wonder that she's so uncertain of herself, because even her parents really disparage her and her chances of marriage.
Yes, exactly. That's true. And you mentioned the options available to someone like Mary, and I wanted to explore that a little bit in writing the book, and yet there were constraints at that time, as we know, and there were many limitations as to what young women could do, especially young gentlewomen, which the Bennets were part of the gentility, even though they were certainly not, they didn't have money. But it was constraining, actually, to write about it. I felt constrained in writing about it, and I realized, probably even after the fact, that I felt that way because there were so few options. You know, it was so, it's so opposite and so different from today that it was almost painful to write about the limited choices that women had. So, and Mary even lays them out somewhere towards the end of the book when she is thinking about what she can do. And she mentions, I think, a shop owner, which she immediately thinks, you know, the family would never go for that. She thinks companion, governess, a couple other things. But as you said, they were, the choices were very limited and just so many constraints for women at that time. And it was fun to explore that, and yet it was constraining in many ways to write about it.
Yeah, explain that to me. That's really an interesting point. You mean that it constrained you in what plot choices you could make, or in what way?
Well, yes. Because when Mary goes to her father, and this is late in the book, so I won't talk about it too much, but she goes to her father and says she wants something more for herself than to live out her life at Longbourn with her parents. There was so little to put into the book that she could, you know, of choices that she would have. And Mary, in some ways, is fortunate because, and I was fortunate in that I had the gardeners, the aunt and uncle, the gardeners who were so, played such a big role in Pride and Prejudice, in getting Elizabeth and Darcy together. And so they are also in Pursuit of Mary Bennet to a very limited degree. But Mary immediately thinks that the gardeners can help her to get a governess position. And but she, you know, she goes, she ticks off the list of things. This is just in her own mind before she talks to her father. She ticks off a list of things that she might do, and they're just so scant, and they're so sort of pathetic and uninteresting. And as you said, a lot of these positions would be basically servants, considered servants, not quite treated like servants, but certainly not treated much better than servants. So, yeah, it's constraining to write about it because it does limit plot choices, plot developments, plot twists, whatever you want to call it. And so it felt a bit like the way it might have felt for women living then. The choices are so few and so unappealing, and you know, it affected the way I wrote the book, and as well as and maybe just that parallel to how it really was for women.
But that's also, I think, what makes it a worthy sequel to Austen. I mean, it's, I want to applaud you for not doing what many people do writing romances set in the past, where they essentially throw out all of the social conventions of the time in which they're writing and have their characters behave romantically as the sort of post-birth control generation might behave. And, you know, so that sense of social constraint and decorum and the things that you could not say, I mean, that's a very large part of Austen. And people just don't talk, you know, the way that even normal people meeting at a cocktail party now would be more open with one another than people who've known each other for years in Austen. You know, there is this tremendous sense of social constraint that goes beyond just the options available to women, but that are considered to be part of good behavior. And in a sense, it almost opens up your story in a way, because one of the things is that when Lydia shows up without her husband, heavily pregnant, on the doorstep, and mm-hmm. there is a scandal attached, and I don't know if you want to go into the scandal, but we'll just say that it's there. The reaction of their older sister is that Kitty and Mary, who are innocent girls, can't be in the house with this.
Can't be in the same home. Yes.
Right, exactly. Right, exactly. So she takes her off to Hightower, which is her home with Charles Bingley. And that's how Mary really gets to make the acquaintance of Mr. Walsh.
Yes, exactly. And that's kind of the catalyst for the rest of the book, is at least in terms of action.
So tell us, you could do this in either order. Either tell us something about Henry Walsh and who he is, or I think there's a passage that you read about Mary, that you would like to read about Mary's interaction with him, one of their early conversations with him. So maybe you'd like to read the passage and then talk about Henry. Either way is fine with me.
Oh, sure. Let me do just a very brief setup for this little scene that I'm going to read. It's Mary and Kitty, as you mentioned, excuse me, have gone off with Jane to Hightower because Lydia has shown up at Longbourn, as you said, heavily pregnant, and there is a scandal attached to that, which is probably a little too much to go into for this interview, but Jane strongly feels that she needs to remove Kitty and Mary from this scene going on at Longbourn. So once they're at Hightower, Henry Walsh comes into the picture, and he is the man who Kitty is definitely fixed her interest on and has convinced herself that he is interested in her. But what we find out is when they get to Hightower is that he pays a lot more attention to Mary in some ways anyway, as a conversationalist and musician and so forth. He's more interested in Mary. So this is a scene not too long after they are at Hightower, and they're at a picnic, all of them. And Henry has asked Mary to climb a peak with him, which in fact is Hightower. And Mary agrees to do that. So here's the scene. We walked at a leisurely pace, hands clasped behind his back. Mr. Walsh seemed content with silence. I liked that about him, that he did not have to fill every empty space with the sound of his own voice. There was no bravado in him. What is your favorite season, Miss Bennett? I thought for a moment. Autumn. And I prefer spring above every other. After the drudgery of a long winter, I'm impatient to get out of doors again. Tell me what you like about autumn. I suppose I love the colors best of all, and the leaves underfoot. And there's something about the air on an autumn day. It shimmers. Does it? His eyes held that little gleam of merriment I'd noticed the other night. I shall have to take note of it this year. We'd come to the base of the peak, where boulders and loose stones made the walking difficult. I slipped, nearly losing purchase, before Mr. Walsh took hold of my shoulders to steady me. When afterward he offered his hand, I hesitated. I felt his eyes watching me, but could not look at him. Miss Bennett, if you will not take my hand, I fear we shall be forced to turn back. The way is too rough for you to walk unaided. I promise to release your hand to your keeping as soon as we arrive on the path. I smiled, still not looking at him, and grasped his hand. In this way we progressed, and in a very short time, placing my hand in his seemed natural. Once we gained the path, the walk, though vigorous, was not difficult. At the top, we found a ledge to sit upon so that we might admire the view. We sat in silence for a few minutes, enjoying the vista. It's breathtaking, isn't it? I said at last. Indeed it is. Now you may understand why I delight in spring. The trees are leafing out, gorse is blooming, and green spreads over hills and peaks like a coverlet. Will you not change your mind, Miss Bennett, and say you like spring best? I could not help laughing. No, sir, I will not. I don't dislike it, though. Charles is a lucky man to have such a grand estate. But you are content with your own estate, are you not? Very much so. You shall see it next week, and I hope you will find it to your liking. I dared to look up at him, and his eyes held mine for a moment. There was nothing there of teasing or mocking, but still I knew I must not read anything into his remark. He might have said the same to anyone who was sent to visit his home. Shall we go? I promised to row your sister around the lake. A reminder of the excellence of his manners and his desire to please. A climb up Hightower with me meant nothing more to him than a spin around the lake with Kitty. On the way down, Mr. Walsh asked my opinion of Southey's biography of Nelson. On the whole, it seems balanced, if slightly biased in Lord Nelson's favor. Have you read it? Yes, a great hero, although the Naples fiasco tarnishes him as well as the conduct of his personal life. You speak of his flirtation with Lady Hamilton. My cheeks burned. I knew it had gone much further than a flirtation, but I couldn't bring myself to say affair. I do. Tell me, Miss Bennet, do you believe we should be judged by the totality of our lives rather than each separate part? You mean should we consider the Admiral's achievements over his whole lifetime rather than dissecting it piece by piece? Precisely. I could more easily esteem his illustrious deeds if he hadn't committed the imprudent ones. You cannot then set them aside? He was a great leader of men. His courage never faltered. He lost an arm and ultimately his life in service to his country. I do admire him for his accomplishments, and yet those imperfections in him... My words tapered off. I wasn't sure what I wished to express. Is human perfection possible, Miss Bennet? I would hate to have my own faults examined too closely. By now we were approaching the others. I wanted to tell him I could forgive his imperfections, but Kitty saved me from saying something so forward by accosting us with her demands. Sir, I've been waiting a horrid long time for you to row me around the lake. She gave me a disapproving look. You cannot keep Mr. Walsh all to yourself, Mary. I was mortified. Henry Walsh bowed slightly in my direction. Thank you for accompanying me, Miss Bennet.
Oh, that's very telling. I'm delighted that you read that passage, because now as I'm hearing it, having read the entire book, I realize what is really being said in that conversation, which I will not share on the air. The question that he's really asking, which turns out to be very important.
Exactly. It's kind of foreshadows something about him. I think it's okay to say that much. Anyway.
Yes, indeed.
But I do think the passage gives you an idea of what he's like. And Mary even says that there's no bravado in him. He's a very genuine, down-to-earth man for the most part. A man who appreciates music and writing. He loves to read. He likes to talk books with Mary, and he likes to listen to her play the piano. Thank heaven she's improved as a pianist. I guess I should say the pianoforte. But in any case, he's not as wealthy as Mr. Darcy. He's about the same degree of wealth as Mr. Bingley. But he is, a gentleman in every respect, a gentleman. So that's Henry Walsh.
Yeah, he seems like a very nice guy. And it's a great passage because it also gives us a clear sense of the difference between Mary and Kitty. Kitty is clearly oblivious to the fact that he is even potentially not interested in her. She has decided on him, and therefore he must be responsive. And she doesn't recognize the difference between good manners and actual interest.
Exactly. And Jane has even warned her early in the book that he has not shown her, and he's not shown any partiality toward her, I think is the way Jane puts it. And that is true. On the other hand, I think as you read the book after they get to High Tor and Jane and Bingley's estate and various social occasions occur, he definitely enjoys flirting with Kitty. And that becomes a little bit of a problem, too.
Well, especially since Mary actually has the same problem, except that the reality is different. In other words, she also doesn't really see the difference between good manners and genuine interest. Or she does, but she's afraid to trust her instincts.
Exactly. And, the whole idea of Mary does have these feelings of being unworthy and being a person that no one would ever be interested in, no man would ever be interested in. She has been told this her entire life by her family, even at times by her older sisters, that she's not, she's not appealing, she's talks too much, she's gives her opinion too freely, she's a terrible singer, she's had her faults pointed out. over and over again throughout her life, and not in a very nice way. And even though she's beginning to change, and Jane even tells her she's changed, she can hardly credit that. She doesn't quite believe it. She can't quite accept it, and even says to Jane, "I'm nobody to admire." So that's a big part of the book, is Mary's challenge, I guess, is to overcome those feelings about herself.
And she's also been somewhat isolated in this family. I mean, it's tough to be a middle child, just even if you have a couple of siblings. But she has four other sisters, two older and two younger, who make natural pairs because of their personalities and their ages. And there she is, kind of stuck alone in the middle.
Exactly. She is the isolated one, as you said, who doesn't quite fit in. We have Jane and Elizabeth, who are very close, and Kitty and Lydia, same thing. And so there's Mary, kind of the odd woman out. And then, of course, not only is she in that situation, but she is also has these various aspects of her character that are unappealing and that people make fun of and laugh at, and in the privacy of their home actually kind of bully her about. So, she's already begun to change at the beginning of the book. She has mellowed to some degree. She has undertaken this course of education that her father, you know, helped her with. She's taking piano lessons. She's profited from visiting Jane and Elizabeth and kind of watching what they do and learning from them. But she doesn't really see that in herself, and she hasn't changed entirely. She has a long way to go. But so part of the pursuit of the title of the book is not just a romantic pursuit by Henry Walsh. It's also Mary's own pursuit of a new way of being.
And I'm glad that you write it that way. I mean, in a sense, it's also Henry Walsh's pursuit of his own way, a solution to his past. But we don't want to go into too much detail with that. But there is that third. I mean, he's pursuing her, but he's also pursuing, I'm not sure what I would call it, an ideal, maybe, or some solution to a problem that he himself has created.
Yes, absolutely. That, and I think also his own way of viewing women, and his own, after he meets Mary, I think his way of looking at women changes to some degree. He likes to flirt, and he likes to flirt with Kitty, and he enjoys that, but I think his view of that begins to change when he meets Mary. So he does pursue also changes in his own personal life and in his way of looking at the world.
So before I let you go, I have to bring up Georgette Heyer. I am a huge Georgette Heyer fan. I cut my eye teeth on her when I was like 14, 15, 16, and I've reread most of the books, and I particularly like the 18th century ones. But I know you mentioned on your website that you're also a fan of hers, so I wanted just to talk about her a little bit, because I was very surprised to discover, I don't even remember when, I think it was probably when I was first writing my own first novel, which is partially set in the, not a real 18th century, but a fictional 18th century. It's called The Not Exactly Scarlet Pimpernel, and it's a play on Baroness Ortsey's The Scarlet Pimpernel, again with a sort of time travel element to it. But when I sent it out, I was working with an editor for a while, and she was totally flummoxed by some of the terminology that I would use, which I had picked up from Georgia Heyer novels. And I started to realize that not everybody had spent her, you know, entire teenagehood immersed in Georgia Heyer.
Reading Heyer.
So I wanted to ask, first of all, how you found her and which your favorite novels are. And just to go into it a little bit so that people, because I think people who have not read Heyer and do read The Pursuit of Mary Bennet and have read Pride and Prejudice would love her. And so it's just like a little extension of the interview so that they can not only read your books, but find a whole new author who was, she's not with us anymore, but she was extremely prolific.
Absolutely. I know that I had heard her name. I knew she was an English writer. I'm sure I had a sense that she was no longer living. But I did not discover Heyer until, oh, probably maybe 6-7 years ago, maybe not even that long. It was after I joined JASNA, which is the Jane Austen Society of North America for the uninitiated. Once you're a member of JASNA, you attend meetings, their local chapters, and we have a Denver Boulder chapter, and we have bi-monthly meetings. And so we always, you know, we're always looking for new topics. Well, 1 month, the topic was Heyer, and I think it was just Heyer because there's a lot there. And I thought, Georgia Heyer, I don't even really know what she wrote. I think I mixed her up with Catherine Cookson, and I think I had seen a couple of Catherine Cookson dramas on Masterpiece or somewhere on TV, so I wasn't even sure about the difference between them. And I might mention there that I'm absolutely appalled that there aren't any dramatizations of Heyer's work. I can't believe that nobody has done an adaptation, you know, film or TV, miniseries, whatever, of any of Heyer's books that I know of. I've looked for them. In any case, she certainly had a great influence on me. Once I discovered her, I just fell in love, and although it took a while, because the first book I read was The Corinthian, and I don't know if you remember The Corinthian.
I do remember The Corinthian, right?
Yeah, I didn't like The Corinthian at all, and I don't think that it would improve upon rereading, so I never reread it, but I tend to like the Heyers that have
older
heroines.
It's better if you read it when you're 16, because like a lot of her early books, there's this incredible age gap between the hero and the heroine, which now really bothers me, but when I was 16, it didn't bother me nearly as much.
No, and, you know, and she has those younger heroines in a lot of my favorite books, but they're usually not the main character. There's a subplot, you know, going on mm-hmm. around a younger heroine. That book, I honestly didn't even remember that. What drove me crazy in reading that was just sort of the silliness of the plot. And that, you know, that can really be true in Heyer. That can be true in those, Sprig Muslin, for example, this whole plot going on there with a younger girl who is running off from her grandfather, and she runs into Gareth, the main character, the older hero.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole wild and crazy plot that's going on with them, and how the way in which it leads to Gareth finally getting shot by accident. And so, but in The Corinthian, though, that whole thing was sort of center stage, that kind of silly plot. So anyway, yeah, I think Heyer in her language, her kind of relationships between hero and heroine, all of those things really have influenced me and as in writing something like Pursuit of Mary Bennet. And my favorites, gosh, I love The Nonesuch. I love Pharaoh's Daughter. I think the dialogue, the whole talk between Max, I think that's his name, Max,
Max.
Deborah. Yeah, Deborah and Max is just priceless. You know, and when Deborah decides to pretend that she's going to marry Max's young cousin or nephew or whatever he is, and he offers her money not to, and then she decides, it makes her so angry that she decides to pretend that she's going to marry him when she really has no interest or intent to marry him.
And her aunt goes crazy because her aunt's broke. She's running a gambling house to make money, and here Deborah has flung millions away.
Yes, all she wants is for Deborah to marry the guy and get all the money. So I think that is one of her best, and I like Frederica, and I like Arabella, even though Arabella does have a younger heroine, but who cannot love Mr. Beaumaris? I mean, really.
Yeah. No, Farrah's daughter is definitely one of my favorites. Frederica is another one. It's interesting. Hayer thought she could write mysteries, and I don't know where she got that impression, but it was wrong.
I've never read one because I've heard such awful things about them.
But in her later romances, she puts in these mystery plots. And that one in Sprig Muslin, I'm reading The Quiet Gentleman now for a Goodreads group. And it is so
kind of a mystery.
Well, it's exactly the same as Sprig Muslin. I mean, they're so similar that I actually thought it was Sprig Muslin until I got into it. And I thought, oh, that's not right. This is not, the names aren't right. They're not quite lining up properly. And so then I thought, oh, I think it must be Sprig Muslin. And I thought it was reading. But anyway, the plot is really, I mean, she has a plot, but plot is really not her strength. They do tend to be kind of absurd. Although Farrah's daughter is one exception. But her characterization is just amazing to me. I mean, she has that Austen-like ability to just nail somebody in 10 words or less.
Oh, absolutely. And you're never in doubt about who are the idiots and, you know, who are the ones to be admired. And, she's just, I mean, even though she doesn't, there's obviously no sex in Georgette Heyer, kind of like Austen in that way, you never have any doubt of who's in love and who, and they can be so romantic even without that whole aspect.
And sometimes I think it's more romantic, you know, like those films from the 40s, you know, where a little goes a long way.
Absolutely. And when you said you were reading Quiet Gentleman, that made me think, and it had struck me a few times lately, it must be because once I was rereading, but, you know, there are certain similarities, obviously there are, but in the beginning of A Quiet Gentleman, I think he comes into the room and he describes, and I don't remember her name because I haven't read that one in a long time, but he describes her as mouse-like, kind of like a
Gisela.
Little mouse.
Yeah, her name is Gisela.
Yeah. And she is that, I mean, you could say that about other of her heroines, like, is it Hester in Sprig Muslin?
Yeah, Hester, right,
kind of
she does.
Mouse-ish aspect about her. Even Ancilla Trent in The Nonesuch has that same quality. She's sitting, Ancilla's frequently sitting and sewing, which is what Drusilla does and what Hester does. And so, yeah, you see the similarities. But I definitely enjoy her older heroines, I guess. But I can sure see how I might have felt differently when I was 16.
Well, and it's interesting to watch the progression, because she started out with these young beauties, and then as she gets older, she tends to focus on the quieter, older heroines, the ones who have been declared spinsters and left aside, but who have real character and usually a great deal of common sense. There's usually a younger woman running around who has no common sense.
Absolutely.
So, as we finish up, what would you like readers to take away from The Pursuit of Mary Bennet?
Oh, gosh. You know, I think to me the most important thing for people to feel is that they loved the story and they found something joyous about it, because that, to me, is Pride and Prejudice. I mean, if I'm sad or upset or in a bad mood, I will frequently go to one of my copies of Pride and Prejudice and reread, you know, parts of it or all of it, because it just, it's like a comfort book. And I would like for people to think of Pursuit of Mary Bennet in that way, that it makes them happy, that it has a joyful or joyous aspect about it. And I guess beyond that, you know, seeing the parallels with modern women and their place in the world, and that it's possible to reinvent yourself if you need to, and it's possible to put off. You know, Mary had to overcome all that negativity that was being put on her by her family. And, you know, we always hear those negative voices, I think, are the loudest ones. As writers, we know that. we listen to that negative criticism a lot more sometimes than we should. And I think Mary certainly had that issue as well. So I think just knowing, you know, that it's possible to get beyond that, to put that out of your head and think of yourself in a new way.
She is that kind of person who could easily grow up to be a writer. You know, I mean, I was a shy teenager. That's why I spent most of my time reading Hair. She did strike me that way as being the kind of person who's an observer. And therefore, if she had the urge to write, she would be a writer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
So speaking of writing, what are you writing now?
I am working on another historical novel that is also set during the Regency. It's not an Austen sequel. It's more of a straight, I guess I'd call it a historical romance kind of book. It has some, has a little politics. It has a little history. It's, but it's primarily a love story. So that's what I've been working on, and I'm nearly done with that.
Oh, great. Well, we wish you the best of luck. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was fun.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. The New Books Network is run by volunteers. If you enjoyed the interview you've just heard, please consider donating to our network. It can be as simple as going to any page at http://newbooksnetwork.com. That's one word, newbooksnetwork. And clicking on the link to shop at amazon.com. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, and today I've been talking with Pamela Mingle, author of The Pursuit of Mary Bennett. You can find out more about her at www.pamingle.com. Like us on Facebook, search for New Books in Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at NEWBOOKSHISTFIC. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can also visit my blog at blog.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. My social media links are under the About Me tab. If you'd like to know more about my novels, you can find that information under the Books tab. Last time I mentioned the New Books in Historical Fiction would be acquiring a co-host and moving to two interviews a month. We still expect that to happen, but I was a bit off on the timing. Life, as it tends to do, has gotten in the way, but I hope the delay will not last more than a couple of months. In the meantime, please continue to check for new podcasts around the middle of each month.